Ladies and gentlemen, the two lectures that I am giving this weekend are lectures in the history of ideas. However, they are lectures not in the history of good ideas, but in the history of bad ideas. The bad ideas I have chosen to focus on are ideas that are extremely influential in our culture. Why depress ourselves by studying the history of bad ideas? Well, as you know, it is an essential position of objectivism that ideas have consequences. Now, since the feelings and actions of so many people have been formed and influenced by bad ideas, it is of the greatest importance to find out what the bad ideas are and to study them in their roots and their origins. So you may regard these lectures as a kind of philosophical biopsy, seeking to find the roots of our present decay. Eventually, it is to be hoped, we shall have a complete diagnosis, perform an operation, and so prepare our culture for the infusion of good and right ideas. If such is our purpose, the political philosophy of Rousseau is especially important for us to understand. For this political philosophy, generated in the 18th century, provided the basic ideas, premises, and terminology for the collectivist movements which began in Europe in the 19th century and which produced such horrors throughout the whole world in the 20th, all the way down through Cambodia. These collectivist movements, Marxism, fascism, and welfare statism, could only have come to power and remained in power by first planting their ideas among the educated classes, then spreading them by cultural osmosis to the people at large. But to be successful in this new missionary work, the new collectivist movements could not present themselves in the form of the ancient doctrine that the individual must simply sacrifice his life or his happiness to the good of society. For the Enlightenment had already won the educated classes over to the idea of freedom, namely, the principle that the individual had the right to his own life, his own liberty, and the pursuit of his own happiness. The new 19th and 20th century collectivisms had to be able to claim that not only were they consistent with the freedom of the individual, but that they and they alone could provide true freedom. To make good this claim, they embarked on a program of redefinition of concepts, conceptual redefinition. First, they took up the new doctrine of the freedom of the individual, defined by the Enlightenment in terms of the rights to life, liberty, and property. Focusing on the right to property, the new advocates of collectivism claimed that the only property the worker had to sell was his own labor. Since his only alternative to selling this property was starvation, and the worker was at the mercy of the employer on the labor market, the worker's much vaunted freedom was, the new collectivist proclaimed, merely a form of slavery. Therefore, for the vast majority of people, said the collectivists, freedom under capitalism was slavery. Capitalist or bourgeois freedom, as they called it in their jargon, was slavery. To remedy this deceptive and oppressive state of affairs, a new social system should be introduced either by reform or by revolution. This social system should be a strictly controlled society in which the state would regulate all activities for the good of everyone. This would guarantee minimum sustenance for all. Although this system would have so many controls it might look like slavery, it was really freedom. Freedom from hunger and insecurity, physical and even psychological. Freedom from alienation. That was the basic freedom wanted by the man in the street. As Bertolt Brecht was to put it much later in the Threepenny Opera, bread first. First feed the face, then talk right and wrong. By the 20th century, the switch had been completed, and it remained only for George Orwell to satirize the collectivist doctrine in his Big Brother's slogan, "Freedom is slavery." If freedom is slavery, then slavery must be freedom. And the new wine of collectivism would have to be served up in the old bottles of freedom. Marxism, fascism, and welfare statism each did this in its own specific way, but they all did it in terms of a set of premises derived from Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Rousseau was well acquainted with the Lockean philosophy of freedom and individual rights, which appeared at the end of the 17th century, and which so influenced our founding fathers a century later. Writing in the middle of the 18th century and just before the American Revolution, Rousseau took the terminology of John Locke and gave it a new interpretation, which became the conceptual basis of the new collectivism. This new collectivism in freedom's clothing soon became a whole culture in itself, reigning on the continent of Europe with Germany as its center. Because of Rousseau's enormous influence on Kant, on Hegel, and on their successors, one educated European can even today hardly speak to another of freedom without committing himself consciously or unconsciously to Rousseau's premises. And, I might add, committing himself inevitably to intellectual disaster. Rousseau was a French Swiss, a citizen of Geneva, the city of Calvin, but he spent most of his life in France. The details of his life are contained in his famous Confessions, which truly deserve the name. I will refrain from giving you the details of his life, which are quite unlike the details of the life of Thomas Jefferson. I am refraining from giving these biographical details so as not to distract you, and because I wish to concentrate on his ideas, and attention to his life would detract from attention to his ideas to an extent greater than would be the case with most other historical figures. So far as his thought is concerned, Rousseau has been subject to the most varied interpretations. He has been interpreted as a back-to-nature primitivist, as a Puritan, conservative, as a Democrat, and as a totalitarian. I shall show that all these interpretations are correct, that they all hang together, and that they are part of a single consistent point of view which he maintained throughout his whole life. In this, I am simply taking him at his own word. In his reply to the Archbishop of Paris, who had condemned Émile, his work on education, Rousseau wrote in 1762, quote, "I have written on diverse subjects, but always on the same principles, always the same morals, the same beliefs, the same maxims, and, if you wish, the same opinions." Again, in his Rousseau, Judge of Jean-Jacques, which he wrote in 1775, notice Rousseau, Judge of Jean-Jacques, he wrote that all his writings were constructed on, quote, "one great principle." But I am not simply taking him at his word. I am seeking to identify that one great principle which he himself failed to do. This morning, we shall examine first Rousseau, the Puritan critic of the Enlightenment. This first facet of his thought is expressed in his Discourse on the Moral Effects of the Arts and Sciences, 1749, often called the First Discourse, the First Discourse. Then we will look at Rousseau, the primitivist. This second facet of his thought, the primitivism, is expressed in his Discourse on the Origins of Inequality, 1755, and is called the Second Discourse. In tomorrow morning's lecture, we will examine yet a third facet, Rousseau's positive political philosophy, the totalitarianism of a democratic people's republic, as set forth in his Social Contract of 1762. In the first discourse, the Discourse on the Arts and Sciences, what is at stake are those things so highly valued by the Age of Reason and the Enlightenment? Not only the urbanity and polite living, the fine arts, music, and literature characteristic of all high cultures, but also Western science and technology to the point of their development in the 18th century. All these had, of course, been praised by the previous thinkers of the Enlightenment. On all these values and achievements, Rousseau makes a radical onslaught. The full title of the first discourse is a discourse on the moral effects of the arts and sciences. The burden of this essay of Rousseau's is that these moral effects are corrupting. The essay was written in competition for a prize offered by the Academy of the provincial city of Dijon. The announced topic was whether the restoration of the arts and sciences, that is the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, whether the restoration of the arts and sciences has had the effect of purifying or corrupting morals. By the restoration of the arts and sciences, the Academy had meant the whole advance of culture since the Renaissance. Rousseau's essay won the prize. It was an enormously immature, even childish work compared to his later writings, but it lays down the takeoff point of his thought, hostility to the basic values of the Age of Reason, urban life, commerce, technological advancement, the fine arts, luxurious reasoning, luxurious living. What are the major characteristics of the progress in the arts and sciences which have occurred in the three centuries just elapsed? That is, from 1450, printing press, to 1750. Why does Rousseau judge them as bad from the standpoint of virtue? What can be his criterion of virtue? Rousseau starts by accepting the standard Enlightenment view that the Middle Ages were barbaric. He is therefore no neo-medievalist. Things, he said, had come to such a pass that a complete revolution was needed to bring men back to common sense. At the Renaissance came the rediscovery of the literature of Greece and Rome, the rise of the sciences, the improvement in the art of thinking, the invention of printing, the revival of the fine arts, the revival in social manners of urbanity, politeness, and decorum, the revival of commerce and money. Then Rousseau, dramatically assuming the manner of the typical Enlightenment thinker, rises to the heights of praise. It is a, quote, "It is a noble and beautiful spectacle to see man raising himself, so to speak, from nothing by his own exertions, dissipating by the light of reason all the thick clouds in which he was by nature enveloped, mounting above himself, soaring in thought, even to the celestial regions, and what is still grander and more wonderful, going back into himself there to study man and getting to know his own nature. All these miracles we have seen renewed within the last few generations. Notice the rhythm is like Marxist praise of the progress under capitalism in the early paragraphs of the Communist Manifesto. Has not all this progress had a purifying effect upon morals? Suddenly reversing the tone of the preceding paragraph, Rousseau answers with a thundering no. All these things have corrupted our morals. They are evil. They ought to be done away with. From what point of view is Rousseau speaking and making this negative judgment? At first, we might think it is the traditional Judeo-Christian standpoint. But this is not an attack on Athens from Jerusalem. It is an attack from Sparta. While in theology, Rousseau is a deist, in ethics, he holds to a military conservatism akin to the anti-intellectualism of ancient Sparta and of the elder Cato in the Roman Republic, akin also to the Stoics. He revives the distinction between nature and convention, going back really to the Sophists as well. He declares that simple and ignorant societies are relatively more natural and more healthy, and that high civilization is a disease. The health he is thinking of is twofold, that of the body and that of the mind. The health of the body is to be in shape physically, and this health is threatened by the luxury and comfort that come with civilization. The health of the mind is to realize that it is dangerous to pry into the secrets of nature. And then, almost in the tone of a contemporary ecologist, he says, "Let men learn that nature would have preserved them from science as a mother snatches a dangerous weapon from the hands of her child. Let them know that all the secrets she hides are so many evils from which she protects them, and that the very difficulty men find in acquiring knowledge is not the least of nature's bounty toward them." So the next time you feel lazy while you're studying, that's nature's kindness towards you. He argues that the sciences are futile in the objects that they propose and no less dangerous in their effects. They also generate idleness and an irreparable loss of time, like in research, you know. The richness of the arts have brought the corruption of manners and attendant vices. The applied sciences do the same, for, quote, as the conveniences of life increase, as the arts are brought to perfection, true courage flags, the virtues disappear, unquote. The meaning Rousseau gives to virtue is important. He means essentially good intentions, honesty, simplicity of life, straightforwardness. Rousseau, you see, is a boy just in from the country. That's the whole attitude he takes toward contemporary Parisian civilization. One of the chief conflicts he sees between such virtue and high civilization is that the market does not always reward good intentions, does not reward straightforwardness, honesty, and simplicity, but very often rewards instead devious intentions, duplicity, dishonesty, tawdry vulgarity. This leads ultimately to decadence and the destruction of any society that is more civilized than its barbarian enemies. At the end of the essay, Rousseau addresses first his deist God and then virtue. Almighty God, deliver us from the fatal arts and sciences of our forefathers. Give us back ignorance and poverty, which can alone make us happy and precious in thy sight. Virtue, virtue, sublime science of simple minds. Are such industry and preparation needed if we are to know you? Are not your principles graven on every heart? Need we do more to learn your laws than examine ourselves and listen to the voice of conscience when the passions are silent?" Unquote. The first discourse, therefore, consists primarily in an attack on high civilization from a rustic, ascetic, puritanical point of view. We hear nothing of any noble savage, nor any glorification of unbridled feelings. There is no neo-primitivism in this essay. The basic objection to advanced civilization is one that it leads to luxury and therefore physical weakness, and therefore danger to the survival of the society itself, and two, that it permits the free market, which leads to an evaluation of persons and products by their surface value, which leads in turn to hypocrisy, tawdriness, vulgarity. There is little mention of freedom in this first discourse, but the implications are clear. The false values of high civilization emanate from freedom in the Lockean sense. Economic freedom and intellectual freedom in this Lockean sense go together. To prevent decadence and restore true simplicity and good taste, we must have a ban on luxury and we must have censorship. Do the philosophes of the Enlightenment bid us to imitate Greece? Yes, however. But what they really mean is Athens. Can it be forgotten, he says, that in the very heart of Greece there arose a city as famous for the happy ignorance of its inhabitants as for the wisdom of its laws, a republic of demigods, rather than of men, so greatly their virtues seemed to those of mere humanity. O Sparta, eternal proof of the vanity of science, while the vices under the guidance of the fine arts were being introduced into Athens, even while its tyrant Pericles was carefully collecting the works of Homer, Sparta was driving from her wall artists and the arts, the learned and their learning. Shades of Plato. Again, he speaks of the frightful disorders which printing has already caused in Europe. He did have this essay printed. He foresees that sovereigns will banish this dreadful art from their domains. He praises the legendary burning of the Library of Alexandria by the Arabs, praises the Romans for expelling physicians, and protests against, quote, the increase of artificial wants, unquote, as, quote, binding chains upon the people, unquote. Here in the 18th century, we have the first hints of doctrines taught in the 20th. When allegedly artificial wants are morally condemned and outlawed, the result is either the Puritanism of John Kenneth Galbraith or Herbert Marcuse's polymorphous sexual orgies, either one supported by a Prussian barracks economy. Rousseau's concept of freedom is action uninfluenced by alleged artificial wants. But so far, in Rousseau's thought, the underlying primitivism has not yet surfaced. The virtue which has been corrupted by advanced civilization is to be found among men not in Polynesia, but in three city-states, the opposite of everything Polynesian, as Polynesia was interpreted by 18th century men. The three great cities are ancient Sparta, the old Roman Republic, and Rousseau's native city, the Geneva of Calvin. Can virtue be defined philosophically, not by ancient Sparta? If asked to philosophize, they merely kicked stones. If an ancient Spartan had been asked what virtue was, he would have been silent or would simply have kicked a stone. By ancient Rome? Yes, the sternest Romans eventually gave in to philosophy. The younger Cato adopted Stoicism. By Geneva? Yes. Rousseau always prided himself on being a citizen of Geneva. Geneva was, of course, Christian, but its true lawgiver, Calvin, was influenced by the Stoics and wrote a treatise on the Stoic philosopher Seneca, who lived at the beginning of the Christian era. Seneca's concept of virtue is that virtue is the only thing valuable in itself. Since all other values are transitory, the essence of virtue is to be found within the mind, in the good intention. A man's true worth is within, so he can never really be harmed. But he can reach this state of virtue only when, quote, the passions are silent, unquote. We're now on our way to Kant. If men were generally virtuous in this sense, Stoic openness, simplicity, and honesty would characterize their social attitudes. They would be valued for their intentions, not their achievements or any outer appearances. Hypocrisy would supposedly vanish. But what of that interpretation of Rousseau, which sees him not as a Stoic Puritan, but as a primitivist, as the glorifier of the noble savage, the advocate of unbridled emotion, the founder of the irrational type of romanticism? Is this latter interpretation wrong? Not entirely. This does not make Rousseau inconsistent. The noble savage theme fits consistently into the whole system of his thought. Let me say by anticipation, Rousseau's noble savage or Neo-Polynesian theme is no more inconsistent with his Puritanism than the sexual liberation movement is inconsistent with the advocacy of celibacy. In 1753, the Academy at Dijon announced another competition. The new question was, quote, what is the origin of inequality among men? And is it authorized by natural law? Unquote. Rousseau says, struck by this great question, I felt surprised that the Academy had ventured to propose it, but since it had the courage to do so, I thought I might have the courage to discuss it and undertook the task. Rousseau did not win the prize with this much better essay, but he published the essay in 1755 with the title, A Dissertation on the Origin and Foundation of the Inequality of Mankind. We have come to call it the Discourse on Inequality, or the Second Discourse, 1755. Rousseau begins by telling us there are two kinds of inequality among human beings. One which I call natural, because it consists in age, health, bodily strength, and the qualities of the mind or the soul. Another, which may be called moral or political inequality, because it depends on convention and is established by the consent of men. The latter consists of the different privileges which some men enjoy to the prejudice of others, such as that of being more rich, more honored, more powerful, or even in a position to exact obedience. Rousseau then says that the natural inequalities are by no means always reflected in the moral, political, and economic inequalities. So you see, by moral inequality, he means simply enjoying a greater approval by society or the lesser approval of society. His object, he says, is to identify, quote, in the progress of things, the moment at which right took the place of violence and nature became subject to law, and to explain by what sequence of miracles the strong, that is the more numerous and the more muscular, came to serve the weak, by which he means the more able few. Think of the many and the few in Anthem. And the people came to purchase imaginary repose at the expense of real felicity. The right upon which inequality is based is only conventional or positive right, right established by legislation. But is such legislation just? To discover this, we must discover what is natural right. The natural rights of man can only be discovered by discovering the nature of man. We can discover the nature of man only if we distinguish what is fundamental in his nature from the changes and additions which he has introduced to modify his primitive condition. We must distinguish, therefore, between the original and natural nature of man and the artificial nature. By the actual nature of man, Rousseau means man as we find him today. Rousseau is saying that in man as we find him today, there are two layers, a natural layer representing man's true, original, and essential nature, and an artificial layer representing the results of progress. Man's true nature is to be found, therefore, in his primitive state. His false nature is the result of his becoming civilized. Man's primitive true nature is good. It is a nature of, quote, celestial and majestic simplicity, unquote. It has become disfigured by civilization. It follows that man's civilized nature is fundamentally bad. It runs contrary to his true nature and suppresses it. Rousseau formally agrees with Locke that there is a morality binding upon man in the state of nature, which is properly called natural law. And he agrees with Locke that it is from this natural law that the natural rights of individuals are to be deduced. But how can we discover the nature of man, natural law, and natural rights? Here Rousseau finds himself in fundamental disagreement with Locke, for Locke's answer was by reason. Locke believed that by collecting facts and by reasoning about these facts, we could arrive at sound conclusions about man, natural law, and natural rights. Whatever the deficiencies in Locke's epistemology when he came to formulating his political philosophy, he fell back on the Aristotelian doctrine that man is a rational animal. But he went beyond Aristotle in the direction of a rational, individualistic doctrine of rights when he, that is Locke, wrote that, quote, natural reason tells us that men being once born have a right to their preservation and consequently to meat and drink and such other things as nature affords for their subsistence. And then comes Locke's deduction, of, as you know, of the right to private property. Body, his man's body and the work of his hands are properly his. Whatsoever then man removes out of the state that nature hath left it in, he hath mixed his labor and joined to it something that is his own, and thereby makes it his property, excluding the right of other men. God, this is Locke talking, for contrast, I'm giving you Locke's. God gave the world to the use of the industrious and rational, and labor was to be his title to it, not the fancy or covetousness of the quarrelsome and contentious, unquote. Of course, I'm quoting Locke selectively, leaving out his appeals to Judeo-Christian revelation and his reservations based on that revelation. I'm just trying to show that Locke believed there was a rational foundation for man's rights, and that he believed that among these rights was the right of the producer to retain the fruits of his labor. This rationally derived right was becoming the foundation of the social order of the capitalist world. Now, Rousseau did not believe any of this. He held to a completely different view as to what was to be included in the list of natural rights of man. It is not surprising, therefore, that he believed in a different method of discovering these rights. Listen to what he says, quote, let us begin by laying facts aside as they do not affect the question. Now, the investigations we may enter into in treating this subject, he said, must not be considered as historical truths, but as mere hypothetical reasonings calculated to explain the nature of things rather than to ascertain their actual origin, unquote. Now, what was the nature of things which Rousseau was trying to explain? The nature of things as he saw it was the depraved, corrupt, infant capitalist civilization of his day with all its inequalities. He believed that the depravity of this society was due to the corruption of man's original essence. So we must find this original essence. How find it? The answer may seem unbelievable, but it is to appeal to the feelings of man via a kind of inner dialogue with himself. Quote, "I shall endeavor to make use of a style adapted to all nations, forgetting time and place, and to attend only to men to whom I am speaking. I shall suppose myself in Athens with Plato and Xenocrates as judges and the whole human race for audience. O man, behold your history, such as I have thought to read it, not in books written by your fellow creatures who are liars, but in nature which never lies. The times of which I am going to speak are very remote, but how much you have changed from what you once were. There is within you something which your education and habits may have depraved, but cannot have entirely destroyed. There is, I feel, an age at which the individual man would wish to stop. You are about to inquire about the age at which you would have liked your whole species to stand still."
This quote is continued by Dr. Walsh on side B. Please turn this cassette over now.
"Discontented with your present state, for reasons which threaten your unfortunate descendants with still greater discontent, you will perhaps wish it were in your power to go back to Tahiti, you see, to go back. And this feeling should be a praise of your first ancestors, a criticism of your contemporaries, and a terror to the unfortunates who come after you. This feeling should be a praise of your first ancestors, a criticism of your contemporaries, and a terror to the unfortunates who will come after you." These words foreshadow the later theories of leftist anthropologists who constructed out of their own imagination the idea that man once existed in a primeval communist matriarchy. This is the point at which they would have liked the whole species to stand still, and to which they wish it were in their power to get back. In this passage also is introduced the term criticism, later put to use by Kant and by the Marxists. And of course the term terror, whose significance became all too clear a few years later in the French Revolution. In the National Convention, which the body which presided over the French Revolution, Rousseau's book, The Social Contract, lay on a kind of altar at the front of the hall. The concept of criticism introduced here by Rousseau is that of an ideal standard not based on fact. Only a few years later, Kant was to adopt this and to call it rational. He was to call it, in the Critique of Pure Reason, a regulative principle. I quote from Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. "Human reason contains not only ideas, but ideals, which have practical power as regulative principles and form the basis of the possible perfection of certain actions. Virtue, and therewith human reason, in its complete purity, are such regulative ideals. We have no other standard for our action than the conduct of the divine man within us, with which we compare and judge ourselves, and so reform ourselves, although we can never attain to the perfection thereby prescribed. Although we cannot concede to these ideals objective reality, they supply reason with an indispensable standard, enabling it to estimate and measure the defects of the incomplete." That's Kant. Rousseau rejects modern civilization as evil. His standard of criticism is man in a state of nature, natural man. But the existence of such a man cannot be established by appeal to facts. We must therefore appeal to our feelings. We find these feelings to be totally alienated from our own civilization. I would rather be in some transcendental Tahiti. We have now found the state of nature. We have found the standard to criticize and perhaps revolutionize our present society. Sound familiar? Well, let us now look at Rousseau's picture of primitive natural man. What was man like, stripped of all the artificial faculties? What was he like just as he must have come from the hands of nature? Quote, I see him satisfying his hunger at the first oak, slaking his thirst at the first brook, finding his bed at the foot of the same tree that furnished him his meal, and with that all his wants were satisfied, unquote. Rousseau is thus saying that when mankind was in its primitive state, nature was abundant, and that man had neither to exercise his reason nor to work in order to satisfy his needs. Why? Because his needs were very simple. Thus, we have a doctrine of one, simple basic needs, and two, of the abundance of nature relative to these needs. Let us expand upon Rousseau's picture of primitive man in the, quote, pure state of nature, unquote. Primitive man had no permanent dwelling. He lived alone. The same persons hardly ever met twice. The union of the sexes was a matter of one-night stands. Children left their mothers and wandered off alone as soon as they were able to fend for themselves. He had no tools, but he did have weapons such as stones and clubs. With such simple needs, they did not need one another. Hence, they were independent. Please notice this use of the term independent. It means to want so little that you can count all your wants on your fingers, satisfy them with the greatest of ease. Quote, the only goods that primitive men recognized in the universe were food, females, and sleep. Their only fears were of pain and hunger. They did not know that they were going to die, hence they did not fear it. They had no foreknowledge, foresight, or curiosity. They were dull and stupid. Their souls were, quote, wholly wrapped up in the feelings of their present existence, unquote. Quote, they were asleep a good deal of the time. Very much like my students. They were violent. They fought, and the strongest won out. The violence was fierce and sudden. If someone got killed, it was regarded simply as a natural catastrophe. No one's feelings were hurt by the murder. That is crucial. This is an essential point in Rousseau's thought now, that no one's feelings be hurt. You could spill all the blood in the world, and as long as you didn't make any of your victims feel put down as he died, you were innocent. A man of good intentions who had momentarily gone berserk. Sounds like Central Park, New York. With a little more social organization, Rousseau's ideal people would be the Manson family. Physically, primitive men were healthier than civilized men. Most of our ills, Rousseau says, have been brought on by civilized life. Primitive men had hardly any physical disorders except wounds and old age. Since there were so few sicknesses, remedies were not needed. There are few sick savages. Ask a hunter how many sick animals he meets. What distinguishes primitive man from the other animals? Free will. The acts of free will, Rousseau says, are, quote, purely spiritual and wholly unexplainable by the laws of mechanics. Here in this doctrine of radical freedom cut off from rationality, we find one of the roots of the existentialist view of man. Still, unlike the existentialists, Rousseau obviously holds that man has an essence, his primitive nature. Another essential difference between man and beast is man's perfectibility or capacity for self-improvement. Now let us look at the ethical side, the moral side of primitive man. It is in what Rousseau has to say here that we find the key to his whole social and political philosophy and the key to the whole social and political philosophy of all his modern disciples. In the state of nature, he says, one great vice is absent, egoism, and one great virtue is present, compassion or pity, la pitié. Egoism is, quote, a purely relative feeling which leads an individual to think more of himself than another, unquote. Egoism arises out of the comparison of myself with another, together with the judgment that person is unworthy and the consequent feeling of contempt. Rousseau regards contempt for another as always bad, without ever asking whether it is at all justified. It is a vice, and as such should not exist. Now, since Rousseau admits that contempt is based on an act of judgment, and as such may have some foundation in reality, he is actually asking that reality be forgotten, and that the act of identifying the reality be declared a vice. Contempt, he tells us, is the origin of hurt feelings and the sense of honor, both of which are bad. If only we could do away with egoism and contempt, we would feel no resentment or desire for revenge against those who kidnapped our children or stole our goods. These acts we would regard as mere natural occurrences, and we would feel toward those who perpetrated them, quote, neither spite nor insolence, unquote. It's hardly surprising that a person who holds such values should regard compassion or pity as the greatest of the virtues. Clemency is pity applied to the guilty. Basic value of some of our judges today. Humanity is pity applied to mankind in general. See, we need it. Notice that the object of all these sentiments, that is the person you pity or the persons you pity, is undeserving of spiritual admiration, like the guilty, undeserving of physical admiration, like the weak, or else this object is conceived in completely general form, as in the idea of mankind, and so devoid of specific virtue. If all guilt were banished, if all sores were healed, if all scoundrels disappeared, virtue in Rousseau's sense would be impossible. We now see what ideal human nature is for Rousseau. He summarizes it, quote, wandering up and down the forests without industry, without speech, and without home. If by accident he made any discovery, he was unable to communicate it to others, and he did not even know his own children. Unquote. Rousseau left his own children in orphanages. In this state, there is neither mine nor thine. Let us call this stage A. Stage A proceeds by a process of transitions lasting centuries to stage B, which is 18th century early capitalist civilization. Stage A then is the pure state of nature. Stage B is early capitalist civilization of the 18th century. This is progress, which Rousseau identifies with the fall of man. The process of transition arises from certain natural challenges that occur, such as the worsening of the climate, a decrease in the supply of food. This challenge leads to the first phase of the transition. Men congregate together and form herds. Population increases, making the hardship greater. By chance, man learns how to preserve fire. Grunts and groans, screams and moans evolve into language. There is some cooperation in hunting, but it is minimal. Then men learned the use of the simpler tools and weapons, recognizing some property in personal possessions, and instituted the family. The family became eventually patriarchal. Villages of huts formed, people sang and danced around a central tree. Remember the oak tree. This is, quote, precisely the stage reached by the most savage nations known to us. This is the stage of the noble savage. This is no longer the pure state of nature. This is Rousseau's own ideal epoch. Notice that Rousseau, unlike so many of his disciples, characterizes his ideal as patriarchal. Then, as history progresses, thinking emerges, to Rousseau's regret. Rousseau tells us that, quote, a thinking animal is a depraved animal, unquote. That, quote, a state of reflection is contrary to nature, unquote. Men begin to trade and therefore to estimate each other's achievements. This leads to pride, to contempt of others, and to competition, all of which are bad. Men lose their original independence. They become dependent on one another. The customer depends on the grocer for his bread. The customer depends on the grocer on the customer depends on the grocer for his bread. The grocer depends on the customer for his business, and so on. We learn to compare the grocers in terms of their ability to get fresh bread in. We learn to have contempt for grocers who have only stale bread. This is bad, because all contempt is bad. Men now judge each other according to whether they have the talent or merit required for the specific tasks of life or for living in general. This means that the more meritorious dominate the less meritorious, and so we have meritocracy, to use a favorite buzzword of today's egalitarians. Grocers with stale bread, surgeons with rusty scalpels, are forced out of business. Rousseau, in order to argue this way, must classify free competition with force. So freedom, by this argument, becomes simply another form of force, and Rousseau has now formulated Big Brother's doctrine, freedom is slavery. This is Rousseau's refutation of Locke. Rousseau has the following objection to estimating people on their merits. Quote, it is a form of force, for either I am forced to acquire the merit, or I am forced to be hypocritical and to pretend to have it. I am forced to cheat. In other words, exams are the cause of cheating. This, again, is Rousseau's refutation of Locke. Rousseau thus sets up the logical structure of the basic argument that has been repeated endlessly by and applied to ever more varied situations by his disciples since his day. It is wrong to recognize distinctions because this makes people unequal. Now, most individuals who make arguments like this never try to justify their assumption that everybody should be equal. This is because they do not want to bring out the real reason that nobody should ever be the object of contempt, even though he deserves it. Rousseau, however, is absolutely frank about this. He supplies the premise. It is worse to be affronted than to be injured. That is why the incompetent must be allowed to hurt people. Just as Rousseau is blatantly open about his premises, so is he open about his conclusions. He sees quite clearly that if he is to have equality, he cannot have the kind of civilization that he lived in Western Europe in the 18th century. For this civilization was based on reason, on the pursuit of luxury, on comfort, and on property. This stage B, the advanced civilization mankind had reached in the 18th century, Rousseau described in the appendix, and again, this will remind you of the Communist Manifesto, the immense labors of mankind, the many sciences brought to perfection, the arts invented, the powers employed, the deeps filled up, the mountains leveled, the rocks shattered, the rivers made navigable, the tracts of land cleared, the lakes emptied, the marshes drained, the enormous structures erected on land, and the teeming vessels that cover the sea. So therefore, a characteristic of state B, the civilization of Rousseau's day, is rationality, logical goal-directed thinking, achievement, the result of the union of reason and man's urge toward self-improvement, the latter based in turn on his free will, the division of labor resulting in mutual dependence, in other words, what should really be called independence, domination, each person dominates those who depend on him. Methodologically, the use of this term involves the refusal to recognize the distinction between force and voluntary relationships. Objective estimation of merit leading to contempt, leading to hypocrisy. Beware, do not misread Rousseau's attack on hypocrisy as a vice that frustrates the objective estimation of merit. Rousseau is less condemnatory of hypocrisy than he is of the objective estimation of merit, which he claims forces people to be hypocritical. Private property began when, quote, it appeared advantageous to any one man to have enough provisions for two, unquote. Inequality appeared immediately with private property. Work. Now work begins. Due to metallurgy and agriculture, we have to work. Iron and corn ruined humanity. Rousseau regards all basic discoveries as due to chance. The accidental emergence of each art resulted in increased specialization. We are now on the way to Marx. The original right to property was merely the right of the first possessor. This is different from the right deducible from the law of nature. Implication, there is a question as to whether the first possessor has any moral right to his land, since Rousseau will not regard it as natural. Therefore, if someone else tries to steal it, is this person doing any wrong? Quote, basing the right to property on labor would have been no offense against equality had talents been equal, but some were able to do more work, and so the balance was disturbed. Too bad. The smith, being smarter, gained more by his work and was able to buy all the corn he needed, but the farmer was not able to buy all the iron he needed. It now became in the interest of the farmer to pretend that he was a smith. Inequality is the source of conflicting interests. Now come the strong thieves who seize property. Their title came from their strength, and it conflicted with the title of the first occupier. So we have two contradictory rights, each with an equal claim to justice, the right of the first possessor and the right of the looter. You see the doctrine of the balance of rights, which came in at that time and later was made so much of by Hegel and eventually came to influence the courts. The result is a wretched situation, battles and bloodshed with rights on both sides. This chaos needs to be cleared up. Then comes the origin of the modern Lockean state, which is a plot of the able few against the disabled many. It's a plot of the few against the unproductive sluggards who are always potential looters. This plot is a proposal for a state that will respect life, liberty, and property, the Lockean state, whose premises were eloquently stated in the Virginia Bill of Rights, that all men are by nature free and independent and have certain inherent rights, that they cannot by any contract deprive or divest their posterity of these rights, namely the enjoyment of life and liberty with the means of acquiring and possessing property and obtaining happiness and safety thereby, unquote. Now, according to Rousseau, this Lockean social contract is unjust because it defines as equality by natural right what is in fact an inequality of concrete goods, which have been gained by an inequality of talents exercised in production and voluntary exchange on terms that are concretely unequal. The origin of this inequality is due to the advance of the human mind. The inequality due to the advance of the human mind becomes at last permanent and legitimate by the establishment of property and laws. This moral inequality is not a natural right. Indeed, it clashes with natural right. In other words, the only real natural right is that based on physical inequality, on difference of muscular strength, the capacity to exercise brute force. Right based on the advancement of the mind is unnatural, conventional, arbitrary. Here, Rousseau reverts to Hobbes. Rousseau finally brings his own concept of freedom into the open by distinguishing between civilized man, who has the wrong concept of freedom, and the savage, who has the right one. Quote, civilized man is always moving, toiling, sweating, and racking his brain. The savage breathes only peace and liberty. He desires only to live and to be free from labor, unquote. So we have abandoned our Polynesian paradise, stage A, for an illegitimate, oppressive state, stage B, which goes against the grain of nature. I have proved, says Rousseau, that man is naturally good, but that he is actually wicked. What can be done? Can we go back to savagery? Must we return again to the forest to live among bears? Maybe you can do so, Rousseau tells his readers. But as for me, I cannot eat acorns. A third solution must be found. This is the social contract, which we will call stage C, which we will examine tomorrow. Rousseau sent a copy of his second treatise on the origin of inequality to Voltaire. Voltaire replied, quote, I thank you, sir, for a copy of your second book against the human race, unquote. Anyone want to ask any questions or raise any point? Bill?
If I understand, when you're talking about man in his natural state, his primitive state, the difference between man and animals is man's capacity for self-improvement?
Yes, that's right.
And then later, the thinking animal is the depraved animal, and the inequality is due to the advance of the human mind.
Yes.
What I don't understand then is how capacity for self-improvement, where that comes from.
Now, think carefully about Christian theology. You see, what distinguished man from the animals was his free will. And with her free will, Eve listened to the snake, remember? And thereby man fell. So there's a kind of a paradoxical situation here, and I think that explains the point. So stage A, primitive man. Stage B, capitalist civilization. And stage C, Rousseau's solution, which we will see next time in the social contract. Any other questions? Yes.
I just wanted to know about the concept of the noble savage versus the primitive man. Just wanted to clarify what you had said about that. That the noble savage is actually beginning to form into groups.
That's right, yes. Sometimes he seems to be praising as his ideal this primitive, chaotic, irrational individualist, in quotes. And sometimes he seems to be praising the Iroquois society of his day. There's some ambiguity as to what his actual view is.
Is it generally taken to be the very individualistic sitting under the tree type of noble savage?
Well, different commentators have fought with each other over which is Rousseau's real view, but actually I think he was just a little confused at the time and he waxes rhetorical and starts sounding off, and I think he just sounded off too far in one direction at one of these points. Yes.
Were the Cambodians trying to achieve that kind of state?
Well, you remember what happened in Cambodia. A group of intellectuals, about 40 of them, who had been studying at the University of Paris, had been studying this whole kind of thought, you say, came back, and they tried to institute a pure and truly moral society throughout all Cambodia. And they decided that in order to do this, they had to drive the population out into the country and put them on the land and re-educate all the children. This proposal was first made by Plato in his Republic. He says we should drive out everybody over the age of 10, drive them into the country. This is called by Plato's commentators the rustication of the populace. And so this concept has remained as a kind of tradition. And there was a doctrine, the doctrine was that Phnom Penh is an artificial decadent place, and we've got to abolish all the whole luxurious order of Phnom Penh with all its luxuries and red light districts and whatnot, and get these people out in the country, get them working hard on the land. And these intellectuals, these philosopher kings who were running Cambodia, they were sincere fanatics. They were absolutely frenzied. They even put up a proclamation on one day that there would be no sexual intercourse in the country for the next month. And so you see that they were rigid ideologues of this kind, following a kind of primitivism.
So we could say that Rousseau was one of the fathers of socialism. Did he make the concept? Did he start that one?
Well, he's one of the fathers of the values of socialism. Actually, as I shall try to explain next time, he believed in private property together with the accumulation of some capital. He's closer to the fascist economists of this century than he is to the socialists, who by definition believe in the so-called public ownership of all the means of production. He never actually advanced to socialism. Yes?
Are there any other concepts that he might have started that we can take note of here?
Well, I'll try next time to summarize them. Yes.
So was Rousseau, anti-sexual? Like, it seems to me that sexuality is about the noblest thing that this thing has, that the primitives have to offer, but I mean, was he an anti-sexual?
Not exactly. I mean, there's a kind of, one often sees in people who are opposed to normal sexuality, kind of a waffling back and forth between a doctrine of what they call polymorphous primitive sexuality or infantile sexuality on the one hand and complete celibacy on the other. And he sort of wavered. His favorite vice was standing in country roads and mooning. That's in his confessions there. Yes. He said that he hoped that some of the passing girls would spank him. Actually, they ran like hell. I guess. Any more questions or comments?
With this paradox, somewhat of freedom, slavery, as you've referred to a couple of times, would you say that Rousseau was at all involved in a dialectic type of argument or not?
Well, thesis, antithesis, and you'll see the synthesis. He was.
And do you personally feel this is one of the bad ideas of primitive grief?
Well, not necessarily. Sometimes actual progress is made by the combination of principles that seem to be antithetical, but I think that interpreting it as a clash between contradictions, that this is totally wrong, and you cannot get any synthesis out of contradictions except in blood. You simply cannot. Yes.
Was Rousseau in his early life in a protected educational environment? I guess what I'm saying, how can he get such a warped idea of primitive life?
Well, there was a kind of what is called a doctrine of primitivism, an idealization of the life of the noble savage. Explorers coming back from Tahiti who had wonderful experiences there, the guys that went out with Captain Cook, you know, and all these people came back with these raving testimonies as to what had happened to them and what they were able to experience there. And of course, what they did not know about at the time were all the complex system of taboos, and you have to be put to death if you allow your mother-in-law's shadow to cross yours and things like that. So what he did, he was relying on the reports of these voyagers and these early naturalists of the 18th century. Yes.
Did Rousseau have any influence on Edmund Burke and therefore ultimately conservative today?
I don't really know.
I don't know. Do you know? Where?
The anti-sexual, the anti-pleasure, the idea that advancing society is a corrupting.
Oh, that part had always been a kind of part of the conservative arsenal, so to speak. You know, the idea that somehow luxury and riches always corrupt. That came down from the speeches of some of the ancient Roman orators, and of course the Stoics had taught that doctrine too. Any more? Yes.
There's the American writer Thoreau, who developed the idea of civil disobedience. Was his concept of freedom based upon a Lockean or so?
He was, in his values, he was some close to Rousseau in his concept of going back to nature. But he also had a kind of, in quotes, individualism. He went away to live by himself. If you want to find a real application of Rousseau's ideas, you should read Walden 2 by B.F. Skinner. There you'll really see it. But not in the original Walden. Okay, well, thank you.